It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll check in with a WPR reporter about how this unusual election day has been going so far. We'll also look at the events that led to today's vote and the effort to postpone it. First, a lot of the things we thought were certain to happen, graduation ceremonies, March Madness, the Olympics, have been canceled or postponed. But we can create our own rituals to count on. People celebrating holidays like Passover and Easter will have to find virtual or socially distanced ways to get together. Birthdays are being celebrated over Zoom and other platforms with BYOC rules. That's bring your own cake. And public figures like comedian Jimmy Kimmel are inviting us to join in their new rituals.
Hey, it's Jimmy. We made it through another one. Merry Christmas, I think. I don't know. I've lost track of time. I do know it's Friday. And not only is it Friday, my wife has declared this to be formal Friday. The idea is to get dressed up as if you're going somewhere, even though you're going nowhere.
Dimitris Zigalatis is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Cognitive Science Program at the University of Connecticut. He also runs the Experimental Anthropology Lab and researches ritual, cooperation, and some of the behaviors that make us human. Dimitris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk first about what we mean by ritual. And people might think it means something really formal, really public, but it can be small too, right? What do we mean when we say ritual in this context?
Certainly. When anthropologists talk about ritual, what we typically mean is those behaviors that either have no explicit goal. A lot of the time when you ask people, and as an anthropologist, I've asked thousands of people why they perform their rituals. And the most common answer is that, well, we just do it. That's what we do. That's who we are. So a lot of the time, those behaviors are performed for no particular reason. And even when they do have some explicit purpose, the means by which we try to achieve that purpose, they're not always causally connected to it. So if somebody asks, is brushing my teeth every morning a ritual? Well, in my book, that's not a ritual because that has a specific purpose. But if you were to wave your toothbrush around in the air every morning, hoping that this would cleanse your teeth, then that would be a ritual.
Now, you say rituals may not have a specific practical purpose, but a lot of your research looks at how important they are for our lives. You even research how ritual affects our brains and our body chemistry. What kind of things do we know?
So what we know is that rituals have very important effects for human beings on at least two levels. So at the individual level, one thing that ritual does for us is provide a sense of structure and regularity and normality. And this tends to happen because, well, ritual is, by definition, is structure. You know, when you're performing a ritual, it's a familiar act. You know exactly what's going to happen. You know how to perform it. It will be done the same in the same way, let's say, every year or every day, and so on and so forth. Now, we know from neuroscience that our brain is essentially a predictive machine. We used to think of our brain in the past as being a passive processor of external stimuli, but now we know that it does much more than that. It uses current information or information from the past and from our environment to predict what's going to happen next. And this might seem very abstract, but one specific example of this is visual perception. In our visual field, we all have this blind spot. And most of us are not even aware that we have this blind spot unless we do a specific test that we can do to figure that out. And we're not aware of it because our brain fills that information in using cues from the environment. So we can function without even realizing we have this blind spot because our brain is constantly trying to predict information. Now, when we're not able to predict information, this is when we experience anxiety. And in cases like this that have a very high level of uncertainty, we see things change every day. We're worried about the future. We see that very often politicians tell us a different thing in the morning, and even health professionals, and a different thing at night. This is very stressful for us. So ritual is one way of at least getting a sense of control. Even if this sense is illusory, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that it makes us alleviate this sense of anxiety. And there are a lot of experimental studies that show this, as well as ethnographic studies.
We're talking to Dimitris Zygalatas from the University of Connecticut. He's an anthropologist. He studies rituals, why we do them, how they affect us. And we're talking about why they may be even more important now during an uncertain time like this coronavirus outbreak, where a lot of the normal parts of life aren't happening like they normally do. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you figured out a new ritual or a fill-in? Maybe that online birthday party, online a faith service. Call in at 800-642-1234. Dimitris, you're starting to get into this. Now we've got this uncertain time, and now these rituals we might have counted on, the little day-to-day stuff or the big graduation ceremony or whatever, they are gone. How does that affect us? How does that compound the anxiety we might already be feeling?
Mm-hmm. So this is another thing that ritual does for us. It gives us a sort of a sense of routine and regularity, not just on a day-to-day basis as we enact those rituals in the moment, but also in the course of our lifetime. So when we look at all human societies, whether past or present, we see that the most important moments of our personal and public lives are marked by ceremonies. And these are typical what we call rites of passage. So those are things like birthdays, like weddings, like graduation ceremonies, and of course, even the end of life funerals are marked by those rituals. And now that people cannot have those rituals, this feels off. It feels stressful. And it sometimes it might take something away from our sense of completing a task or having an accomplishment. For example, when I told my students, when we discussed the current situation on the last day of classes on campus at the University of Connecticut, and I told them that classes would be moved online, the first thing that my students asked me was, what about our graduation ceremony? What will happen in May? And when I told them that I expected that the ceremony would be canceled, I could really see the disappointment in their faces.
So here we are without our usual rituals, again, either daily or weekly ones, or these rite of passage things like graduations. Is it possible to, you know, invent our own new rituals that are going to function, that are going to take the place of the stuff we're missing?
Well, we definitely see this happening right now. This is the best example of this. All over the place, people are either adapting existing rituals or creating new ones. So in terms of existing rituals, some of these age-old rituals, people are finding radically new ways of celebrating those. One example was this couple in Manhattan that was on their way to get married, and then they heard that the New York City Marriage Bureau had just been shut down because of the coronavirus. And what it is that they called a friend of theirs who was an ordained priest and asked them to marry them from his fourth floor window. So they got married in the street. And their friends gathered around at a safe distance and honked. We're also seeing things like drive-through birthday parties or drive-by birthday parades. We even see virtual funerals or last rites being administered by the phone and so on and so forth. And at the same time, you see all those rituals that are emerged spontaneously. You see a lot of individual rituals, such as the one you mentioned by Jimmy Kimmel's suggestion, that every Friday we all dress up, and we, instead of casual Fridays, now we have formal Fridays, right? And also collective rituals. You see people coming up with a lot of those types of rituals to maintain a broader sense of human connection, which is the other side of ritual, the social aspect of ritual. In many European cities, we now see that people have started to go out in their balconies at the same time every day, and they applaud healthcare workers. And we even see the opposite happening. We see the authorities, for example, in Mallorca in Spain, local policemen would gather to sing and dance in the streets for the people who are in lockdown, who were able to observe this from their balconies.
We're talking to Dimitris Zygalatas, an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Cognitive Science Program at the University of Connecticut. And we're talking about rituals. The things we do in a certain way at a certain time could be something big or something small. And it could be something that's been disrupted now by the novel coronavirus and the efforts to prevent its spread. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had some ritual you were counting on disrupted, whether it's the weekly service at your religious organization, if it's a wedding, if it's a graduation you were hoping to be at, and now that's probably off the table? Or have you created something new, either to give a sense of routine or to replace what you usually would have done? My family, we just had a virtual birthday party for a couple of kids over the weekend with a bunch of us seeing each other on screens and various sorts of cookies and cupcakes and cakes showing up along the way. Have you done something like this yourself? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Mike Galatas. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Cognitive Science Program at the University of Connecticut. He also runs there the Experimental Anthropology Lab. We're talking to him about his research on rituals and how they can provide comfort to us in times of uncertainty. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a person who finds comfort in rituals, personal or public or family? Have any of your regular rituals, like celebrating a holiday, say, or a birthday, had to change lately? Have you created some new ones yourself or in your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Cheryl is with us in Wauwatosa. Cheryl, hello.
Hi. Thanks for doing this show. It's really interesting. I just wanted to say what we did is my son is in the Army Reserve, and he's going to be leaving within the next 2 weeks for a year-long deployment. And so everything we have planned to do for a goodbye has obviously been canceled, no parties or anything like that. So what we did is last Sunday, he sat in a parking lot, a big parking lot, and we invited people to, we made signs and we had balloons and all kinds of things out there to say goodbye. And then we invited people to drive by at a safe distance, and they could, you know, talk to him from a safe distance just for a short time, and then give him their well wishes and then move along as other people came through. And we had a really good turnout, and it really made him feel good.
Cheryl, thank you so much for sharing that. How creative. I appreciate it. Pass our best wishes on as well, and thanks for calling in. Demetrius, we can be pretty inventive in times like this, can't we?
Yes, absolutely. And, of course, when it comes to individual rituals, that might be easier. Those are things that we do alone. We do in our own privacy, or our own homes, when we're talking about things like, from religious things like prayer or other kinds of things like your morning coffee. These are things we can still do. But when it gets to those collective rituals, the social aspect of ritual, this is the toughest part to replicate in a social isolation settings. And this is where you see that people are beginning to get the most creative. So just like the example we heard, I've come across all sorts of other rituals that have happened by bringing people together in their cars or online and trying to keep as much regularity as they can. So as many elements of those rituals be the same, let's say the balloons or the cake, and then substitute for all of those things that you can't have.
Cheryl, thank you so much for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Demetrius, is that going to be a problem for us? I imagine this is so new, we don't have experimentation on this, but is a public ritual not done in the company of people? The social element of it is, the direct in-person social element of it is missing. Is that going to feel the same to us? Is it going to do the same stuff?
It is really difficult because one of the main aspects of those rituals is the embodied aspect. So what we do with our bodies, how we interact with each other. For example, we know that one of the ways those rituals are having the effect that they have, and those effects are creating a sense of shared identity, a sense of connection and community. We've done, in my own research, we have done things like measure hormonal responses, for example, and you see that endorphins, hormones that are associated with social bonding, they tend to increase when we engage in synchronous activities with others. Now, those are very difficult elements to replicate in a social isolation context. but we try our best. One such example are people who are coming online and trying to either sing together or dance together. For example, we have some dance parties now happening. Clearly, I was recently talking to somebody, to a friend of mine who attended one of those parties. I asked him, was it the same, just like being on the dance floor and dancing with 1,000 people? And both of my friends said, well, of course it's not the same, but it's the best we can do at this point, right?
Well, and given that probably people are really hungry for it in ordinary times, no, it might not be the same. If we're missing it that badly, it might have, you know, that similar uplifting element if we're just really, really looking for it.
Absolutely. And some of those rituals, some of the rituals that we see emerge now, they can have the same embodied effects in the sense that people are even finding ways of doing these things together, even though they're socially distancing themselves. So some examples are people going out in their neighbors, going out on the street at the same time every day and singing together or dancing together. You know, you don't have to be touching each other. You can maintain a safe distance of 10 feet or 20 feet even and still be engaged in this relatively large-scale collective ritual that is dancing in the street or chanting or applauding from your balconies. And sometimes you get the same effects, which is even you get these goosebumps that anthropologists have called collective effervescence that are the result of engaging in these synchronous activities with a large crowd.
We're talking about ritual, the importance of rituals in our lives for our well-being and how people are getting creative in a time when a lot of our regular rituals are disrupted to try to stop the spread of the pandemic right now. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Dimitris Zygalatas with us, anthropologist at the University of Connecticut. Back to your calls now. Janice is with us in Williams Bay. Janice, hello.
Hello. For the last 20 years, there's a group of us that have met every Sunday for dinner at Hernandez Restaurant in Delavan, Wisconsin. And so, of course, you know, we can't go into the restaurant anymore. But since the weather got good, we all did last Sunday. We all ordered carryout, and we met in the parking lot with our lawn chairs.
All right, at a safe distance, Janice?
Yes, we even
fantastic.
And somebody threatened to bring their yardstick, and it's each parking spot is 8 feet across. So we had the white lines that showed us, and we also had we were eating in the center that had a grassy divider in it. So,
and let me ask Janice, how was it? How was it to be out there with your friends for your regular Sunday dinner gig?
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. We had all gotten to the point of being so, you know, isolated. And granted, we couldn't hug each other, which we usually did. And so we gave air hugs. But no, it was great just to, and it was nice to have good weather, too. But it really satisfied a need.
That is fantastic, Janice. I love it. And I like there, Dimitris, I know a lot of ritual, big and small, involves food and sharing food at the same time. Can you talk about the importance of maybe working some of that into our newly created rituals?
Absolutely. Sharing food is something that is really fundamental to our social nature. We can only imagine that our earliest ancestors, since the first time they gathered around the fire, they have been sharing meals. This is why the most important moments of our lives, all of our important ceremonies, they typically involve sharing food. We have it at our weddings and our biggest religious festivals, and now we have Easter and Passover coming up. In my home country, I come from Greece, every family typically gets together and roasts an entire lamb for Easter. And then they have something to eat for the rest of the week. So sharing food is a very important aspect, not just of ritual, of our very social nature. And it's very important for people to, especially with several holidays coming up now, to maintain this sense of sharing and this sense of connection. I've done it. My wife and I have recently done it with friends. We have virtual dinners. It doesn't have to be a major disruption. And having somebody in front of you through a screen doesn't have to be terribly different than just having them right there.
Yeah, Demetrius, in our last few minutes, I wanted to talk about some of those really important religious ceremonies coming up, Easter, Passover, Ramadan, just around the corner. Do you have thoughts for people on ways that they can, you know, do things that are important both to their faith and their culture and their family and still come away from it with that seasonal sense of renewal?
I think that my advice is for people to just get creative. When it comes to individual rituals, look for what helps you establish a routine, a sense of regularity, and observe those routines faithfully. Make sure you create special moments, you know, dress up, cook special meals, exchange presents, whatever you would do in the context of those rituals, whether those are religious rituals or secular rituals. And if there's a special moment coming, let's say Ramadan or a birthday or a wedding anniversary for that matter, do have that celebration. Do not neglect it, because those are the kinds of the moments of our lives that leave us very disappointed if we end up missing. The example of our from our last caller is very telling here. Do have that celebration, even if you have to be creative. So you can't go to a restaurant or invite friends over, but you can still dress up. You can order some flowers for your anniversary. You can get some wine and cook a special meal for your wife. Or you can gather some friends online and have your Passover dinner. Or you can throw your children a surprise party. And the second point is look for ways to connect with people outside of your household. We do these things for our family, and if anything, some of those things might now be easier to do because we spend more time with our core family, our nuclear family, being isolated. But especially important, look for ways to connect with people outside of your household, especially those elders, our parents or grandparents who are socially isolated. Make sure you include them in those rituals, include them in those meals. And if they don't know how to use Zoom or Skype, maybe this is a good time to teach them.
Demetrius, that's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Demetrius Zigalatis is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and the Cognitive Science Program at the University of Connecticut. He runs the Experimental Anthropology Lab there. He joined us today to talk about the value of rituals, big or small, in daily life. You can still share what you're doing over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the drama that unfolded yesterday in the run-up to today's election, and we want to hear from you about your voting experience. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the public health measures put in place by states and the federal government are becoming a divisive issue for some. We'll talk about what it takes to create unity during a time of crisis. Now, after some uncertainty over the timing of Wisconsin's spring general election, voters headed out to the polls today as originally planned. They're casting ballots for state Supreme Court justice, a statewide referendum about crime victims' rights, the Democratic presidential primary, and a lot of local races and referenda. With an executive order yesterday, Governor Evers tried to postpone the election, citing concerns over the coronavirus, but top Republican state lawmakers said he didn't have the power to do that. Hours later, the state Supreme Court agreed, so here we are today. And a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that came down yesterday requires absentee ballots to be postmarked or delivered by 8 o'clock tonight. We'll get into all of that in just a bit. First, let's find out how things are going at the polls. Corey Hess is with us, Wisconsin Public Radio reporter in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob.
We've been hearing your reporting in the state and national news today, Corey. Can you give us a sense of what you're seeing at the polls and what you're hearing from people there?
Well, what we're seeing is very long lines. In Milwaukee, there's normally 180 polling places, and today there's 5 polling places open. So voters are waiting anywhere between an hour to 2 hours to vote today.
What's behind the decision to cut to such a small number of voting stations?
Well, the Milwaukee Election Commission just answered that question a few minutes ago, and they said that that decision was based on the number of COVID-19 cases that the city has seen. Milwaukee has the most cases in the state. They are over 1,000 cases at this point. So they said that they chose to only open 5 polling places because they thought that was the number that they could safely staff.
and a lot of poll workers, as you mentioned, have said that they can't put themselves at risk of COVID-19, so they're staying home with these five stations. Does it look like they are adequately staffed?
It does. They've got about 30 poll workers at each one of these locations. And what they did was they brought in people from the National Guard to staff them. You know, typically these polling places have volunteers, and a lot of times they're over 60 years old. So they don't want to put older workers at risk.
I know you're on the job today, Corey, and I want to let you get back to it. But I want to know, what are you still watching for? What kind of questions remain to be answered today?
Well, you know what we're watching for is to see how many people are still going to be in line at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night when the polls are closing. What the Election Commission has said was if people are still in line at 8, they will be able to vote. So they are going to make sure everyone who is in line and has been waiting gets to vote.
Corey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Corey Hess is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter in Milwaukee. Now let's talk about how we got here and how the election process may unfold today and over the next few days. Charlie Jacobs is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, what do you make of this run-up to this election day, the attempt to postpone it at the last minute? This is not standard operating procedure.
It is not, and it's been kind of a sloppy, hot mess that I think in some ways could have been avoided if everyone had played a little nicer in the sandbox and recognized that we are facing conditions that I think most people haven't seen in their lifetimes, at least those who would be involved in this decision-making process. I mean, we're not alone. The state of Wisconsin is not alone in having to grapple with this problem. 15 other states which had primaries scheduled for April or soon after the end of April, they moved their primaries, and it wasn't without some glitches and some problems, but they were all managed to do it. What's fundamentally different for Wisconsin is that we also had the nonpartisan elections going on at the same time, and that runs into issues of what do you do with positions that end before you could reschedule the election and the like. And it really would have taken a concerted effort, I think, by the legislature and the governor to have some foresight here and to get together early to try to resolve this. But it seems like everybody was moving in fits and starts, and they didn't really know exactly what powers they had, which direction to go, and how to resolve the issues.
Nina Mayer and former Republican state lawmaker Dean Coffert told WPR a couple days ago that he's not very happy that the election is happening. He said, I want to give a listen. He says both Republicans and Governor Evers share some blame here.
I still think it's the wrong decision. I think the legislature and the governor, they're not listening. Again, I was in the legislature for 24 years. It's somewhat pathetic. I mean, what a mixed message. Telling people, you know, in the height of this pandemic to stay home, not go out unless they have to. All the messages that are being sent, but then on April 7th, we can throw them all out the door.
So there's a lot there, Charlie. One, he's talking about what you mentioned there, the sides not playing well together. How could leadership, Democrats and Republicans, have maybe handled this, as you see it, in a better and more orderly way?
Well, certainly, I think the governor and his administration could have reacted more quickly. I mean, he created a number of emergency orders that had far-reaching impact, like shutting down the schools on the 18th of March. At that point, recognizing that they had 3 weeks until an election, they might have started formulating a plan and working more directly with the leadership and the legislature to remedy this problem. But at the same time, the legislature can't just sit on its hands and wait for the governor to act. They have independent power from the executive, and if they believed that there were an issue, they could have filled whatever leadership void was absent in the governor's office and tried to come up with a plan. And then when you finally see the governor take some steps, when the legislature comes in and they gavel in and gavel out a session literally within minutes without addressing any of the substantive issues, it makes you wonder whether or not either or both sides were realistic about what it would take to avoid this kind of problem of potentially spreading the disease. I mean, Michigan, many are arguing, exacerbated their COVID-19 problem because they were one of almost zero other states who actually held their primary on time. And it was after that date that we saw the transmission explode in that state. So one has to hope you cross your fingers and this doesn't have the same kind of impact.
I want to give a listen to Governor Evers. Now, this is a few days ago, a few days before he gave the executive order trying to move the election, maybe here painting himself into a corner. Here's a listen.
I can't do this or move this election or change it on my own. My hands are tied. And that's why I spoke to the legislative leaders about this weeks ago. I even publicly called on them to act. They have made it clear they are unwilling to change.
And then Republican leaders in their core challenge cited that statement when they challenged Evers' claim that he did, in fact, have the authority. Again, part of the whole sloppy hot mess phenomenon you referred to earlier, Charlie?
Yeah, I mean it's funny. It's the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, they had opportunities to try to remedy this situation. And, you know, in their filing, their emergency filing yesterday, you know, the Republican leaders said that they worried about voter confusion and disenfranchising voters. Well, no matter which way this went, you were going to confuse voters and probably disenfranchise some people. So to make that argument is a little hollow, because whichever direction you go, there was going to be a significant problem. But, of course, if they had sat down on Saturday when they came in a session and tried to come up with some sort of solution that would have satisfied both sides and hopefully at least reduce that confusion and reduce the disenfranchisement, it would have been helpful. It's going to be interesting to see what turnout is like. I mean, in the last several elections where you've had an incumbent president running in a primary here in the state when we also had the April elections, turnout was in excess of 22% or 23% on average. So we'll see whether or not we hit that number or whether or not we've depressed turnout because of the worries about the pandemic.
Another issue here, apart from the election going forward at all, is the issue of absentee votes, when they have to be postmarked, when they can be counted. We'd had a federal court judge extending the deadline for those ballots to be postmarked or delivered. The U.S. Supreme Court then, after a challenge, said, nope, got to be today in effect. What's your understanding of the current state of affairs when it comes to absentee ballots?
Well, the issue that was really facing the Supreme Court was a ruling by the district court judge in the Western District of Wisconsin, where he extended the date by which you could have your ballot postmarked. And in essence, you would very possibly be voting after the end of the election, and that might create confusion and problems, because is the election actually over? What happens if certain amounts of the data leak out? Will people still feel confident in exercising their right to vote? And what the United States Supreme Court said was, in our precedent, we have always said, don't mess around with the rules of a state regarding voting immediately before an election because of the confusion that it creates. Now, the dissenters from the Supreme Court argued, you're doing the same thing by coming down with another ruling so close to the election. So the federal courts didn't make this any easier and created lots of problems. And so as it stands, you've got to return your absentee ballot by 8 o'clock tonight. Now, there's something funny about what the Supreme Court said, because they said, well, once the election is over, it's over. But as Corey just mentioned, if you're standing in line at 8, where the election is technically over, you're still allowed to vote. So there are all these little slippages in the system that create opportunities for people to actually exercise their right. But it seems like both the legislature, the governor, and the courts are just making even messier a situation that was created by this virus.
We're talking about today's election, how things are going at polling locations, efforts to delay it, and more. Charlie Jacobs is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you head out to vote today? Did you work at the polls? What was it like? How did you feel? Do you think the election should have been postponed? Are you glad it went forward today? Have you had trouble getting an absentee ballot, as some people have reported? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about Wisconsin's spring election today with Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College in De Pere. If you haven't voted yet, you can still vote at your local polling station. If you're trying to vote absentee, it is due today. You have to have it postmarked today or delivered today. That extension that existed briefly is no longer in place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the decision to keep this election going today? Good idea, bad idea? Have you voted? Have you worked at polls? What are you seeing there? Did you vote absentee already? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ron is on the line in Greendale. Ron, hello.
Well, hello. I have an understanding that the Supreme Court stayed home today while asking the voters to go, insisting that the voters who did not have a ballot or did not receive their ballot though requested, et cetera, et cetera. They're expecting us to come out and function normally, whereas they are not.
Ron, thanks for the call. And Charlie, as I understand it, the Wisconsin Supreme Court is operating remotely and they've canceled some of their regular functions. I think that's what Ron is referring to.
That's true. And it's hard to tell exactly what justification the state Supreme Court is using. You know, this was an emergency petition of the court. And when that happens, they often vote and then they will provide a more substantive discussion later. So it's hard to know exactly what it was based upon. But remember, courts are often constrained in the American legal system by precedent and by their interpretation of various constitutional and statutory provisions. So before we cast, you know, really significant aspersions at the court, we've got to wait to see what they write and understand the reasoning behind it. And look, I mean, the governor himself said he didn't have much to stand on. Then he used that little he had to stand on. So I think even he knew he was in a little bit of trouble if this was going to get reviewed by a court. I mean, he's relying on the preamble to the state constitution, which is about the least effective constitutional clauses you could possibly employ to exercise a power or authority. That's both in states and at the national level. So he was in real trouble here with this particular effort, but I think he felt as though he had to do something or try something, and this was the last gasp that he had.
Ron, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard on Facebook from Deborah, who says she just voted in rural Sauk County. It's always a slow, steady flow, but they have a great setup. Deborah says you sanitize your hands when you walk in the door. There's tape on the floor to mark the 6 feet of distance. You can bring your own marker, which Deborah says she did. The voting judges stay far back from you. You exit out a different door. But Deborah says, I was worried. I've not been anywhere in more than 2 weeks and did not like being exposed. But Deborah says, I must say they were well prepared. Charlie, can you talk about what we're hearing about how local voting agencies have dealt with this?
Yeah, I think, you know, in their attempt to try to make sure that they're protecting the public, but also meeting their obligations under state law about what's required of voters when they show up, they've been really invented, you know, drive-through voting where the officials come up to your car window to try to reduce the, you know, the interaction. I think one of the issues is going to be whether or not we get reports after the election about efforts that were being made in good faith that may have run into a gray area about whether or not it was appropriate, but one wonders whether or not there's going to be any challenge or litigation regarding these, considering the circumstances that everybody is facing.
Let's go back to our callers. Carolyn is with us in Kenosha. Carolyn, hello.
Yeah, hi. Hello. How are you, Ron?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I was not able to vote today because of COVID-19. I'm not going out in the lines. And I did request a mail-in ballot, which I never received. So for the first time as an adult, I will not be voting in a primary or presidential election. So I'm very upset.
Carolyn, thanks a lot for the call. We've heard some reports, reporters, individuals saying, just like Carolyn, they'd ordered a ballot in advance and never gotten it. Charlie, is there any kind of recourse out there for people in that situation?
Unfortunately, there isn't. I mean, and this was the issue that was facing the district court in Madison. They wanted to extend this because they understood that clerks were overwhelmed with the request for absentee ballots. And so they were trying to just give a little wiggle room so that they could be delivered and then returned for those individuals. And I think there's some confusion among voters if they applied for an absentee ballot, it hasn't yet come. Could they go to the polls and cast a ballot? So again, this is this argument that comes from the Republican leaders about the problem of disenfranchisement and confusion. That was already layered into the process. The question is what are our elected officials going to do to relieve that? And really, they didn't do much of anything because they were squabbling about exactly who was responsible and how they were going to affect a change in a short period of time.
Thanks for that call, Carolyn. We're talking to Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College, looking at today's election day and the run-up to it. Back to your calls now. Patrick is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Patrick, hello.
Hello. Hey, you know, just got to put my point in here. You know, the date of this election has not moved, and we've known for months and months, if not, I don't know, a year, that this was the day. Okay, so that hasn't crept forward or backward. And, you know, we have our constitutional right to order a ballot. If people think that they can order a ballot, like, I don't know, 72 hours before they're supposed to be handed in, and then they got to complain about, hey, I couldn't get my ballot, I couldn't vote, you know what, that's kind of on them. You just made a point about our elected officials, whether they were asleep at the wheel or not. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. I think a lot of people throughout different ranks of government, all the way to Wisconsin's county, we're asleep at the wheel on this one, okay? So don't be shocked, folks, because you didn't get the vote. You can't wait till 72 hours before it's due and think you're going to get that vote, that ballot, delivered to you.
Thanks a lot for the call. We've seen, of course, Charlie, a lot of people saying they'd requested their ballots in late March, so about a week, at least in some of the anecdotal cases. What's your response, Charlie?
Again, this is such an unusual circumstance. It's hard to point fingers and cast blame on certain individuals or certain actors. Everybody has a certain level of culpability, but at the end of the day, our public officials are there for a particular reason, which is to try to resolve emergency issues like this. And I think that there was some question about how fast this was going to spread, what the impact was going to be. And really, the governor acted relatively quickly in the early weeks of March to try to remedy this in a number of ways. And the legislature had a similar amount of time to do it. Why they didn't react quicker and come up with a resolution for the public, because the public is probably least equipped to try to understand the methods that are available to them to secure that absentee ballot or to protect themselves when they go to the polls. They have to rely on those in these positions. And so I think that we can sort of at least discuss what went wrong with the intervention by our state government to try to help out voters to make sure that they could cast their vote like Carolyn wanted to do and couldn't do for the first time in her adult life.
Thanks a lot for that call. Charlie, I want to take our last couple of minutes to look to the future. Some people are watching us here in Wisconsin and saying, okay, what if this thing is still around come November's election, or what if it, you know, dissipates but then picks up again in the fall? What kind of lessons can we learn here so that this isn't a fiasco on a national level?
I think all states have to at least create some sort of statutory provisions that give some flexibility primarily to the executive and maybe with the health department in the state as well to make decisions about exactly how this is going to occur. I think what happened in particular in Wisconsin is there's almost no language that allows for the governor or the Board of Elections to make these kinds of changes in emergency situations. So I think it's incumbent upon legislatures and governors to start to work together to figure out what they're going to do if COVID-19 hasn't dissipated by the time we run this election. And that's going to take a lot of hard swallowing by partisans on both sides to sit down at the table, because these are contested elections, which mean power. But if we are serious about issues of disenfranchisement and voter confusion, that's the kind of hard work that has to get done in the context of everything else that they're doing right now.
And briefly, Charlie, I mean, you know, maybe we wouldn't have predicted this particular pandemic, but given that, you know, there are diseases out there, there could be cyber attacks, natural disasters, why don't we have more contingency plans in place for election days?
I just, I, I don't think we believe that could actually occur, that we would disrupt something like this, that we would somehow be able to overcome it. But I think 9/11, more than anything, exposed potential weaknesses. And I think the other problem that we've seen here is that any attempt to alter the electoral system of the United States over the last decade or so is viewed through a microscope and with grave suspicion that somebody is trying to game the system for their benefit, whether or not it's changing how long you have to cast an absentee ballot, why you qualify for one, whether you show a photo ID, whether you extend voting times. All of these raise a question about, are the Democrats gaining an advantage or the Republicans getting an advantage? Instead of just recognizing that, you know, as small D Democrats, we should all have the hope that as many people who are qualified to vote can exercise that right and pick the people to represent them in office.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Have a great day.
That's Charlie Jacobs, political scientist at St. Norbert College in De Pere. We talked to them today about the drama surrounding Wisconsin's spring general election. You can still share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Yesterday on Central Time, we talked to WPR music host Lori Skelton, who shared some great suggestions from our WPR music staff for great listening during uncertain times. We heard some Bach and some banjo, some Vaughn Williams and some Aretha Franklin, and soundtracks like Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter. And you shared some of your favorites. Here are a few more that you shared on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can keep doing that, by the way. Share your comforting go-to listening. David simply told us he turns to reggae, which is fantastic. I can totally see that. And with, nice weather and open windows, reggae is awesome. Stuart said Simply Folk is wonderful. I think a lot of people turning to our Simply Folk programming on the weekend. Terry says J.S. Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, and Verdi. Lisa recommends instrumentals by various artists, Patchouli, one I'm not familiar with, Michael Goulezian, and others. And speaking of instrumentals, I got some great new ones. My longtime favorite, Nine Inch Nails, released in the crisis for free two new albums, Ghost 5 and Ghost 6. It's a series of instrumental stuff, and they're strangely comforting. You don't usually think of Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails as your comfort listening, but these really kind of are. We'll go out with one of the pieces on Ghost 5. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.